to minute 53 of season 3 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, coming to you from the Boston area, and once again joining me is my host, the host with the most, I guess you can say, Sean German of the Next Scene podcast. Welcome back to the show, and thank you once again for hosting me so that we could do this in person.
Yeah, welcome back to the studio, and thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, again, it would be pretty uncomfortable if I brought someone else in. Yeah. You know, I'm going to call Turney. Turney, come over to Sean's house. You know, we'll record without Sean. You know, that's just use studio time at Sean's place. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that would work. So, minute 53 begins with Carl poking the air shaft with his gun and ends with John moving towards a bloodied and brain-splattered door. Mm-hmm. So, yesterday we ended the minute with Carl shooting many bullets into the air conditioning shaft. Miraculously for John, missing. Not miraculously for Carl, missing. that would have changed the movie quite a lot if he would have actually, even if he would have just winged him. You know, if he would have gotten him anywhere, you know, there'd be blood oozing out of the air conditioning, and you know, John wouldn't be able to run across the glass later.
Yeah, yeah, probably would have been a shorter film because he would have seen the blood and instantly known.
Well, we talked earlier this week that you like having movies that are shorter, so yeah. You know, it might have taken on. I mean, I don't know if it would have still made it to an hour 40, you know, 100 minutes.
Yeah.
If we're only at 53, I don't know if they would be able to squeeze out another 47 and a half minutes of John bleeding all over the place. I don't know.
Yeah, might have been a better film. Who knows?
Wait, what do you mean? There can't be a better way of Die Hard.
No.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, so we have that trope where our protagonist is about to get caught and the bad guy is closing in and then suddenly called away.
Right, something happens along the way. So Carl starts moving towards the shaft, and then he very interestingly, I don't know if I would have ever thought to do this, he starts poking or pushing up the vent with his gun. Meaning, what do you think he's trying to figure out here?
I think he's trying to figure out where John is. And
no,
he figures,
I know,
like,
but I'm saying,
well,
what do you think the indication would be for him?
The weight, there'd be some resistance, you know, pushing against this, you know, the thin metal that the duct is made out of that bends and, you know, you can push on very easily versus if he feels the weight of a full-grown human, you know, pushing against the metal, he'd be able to tell.
Sure. But it's very interesting. I don't know if I would have thought to try it that way, you know, just by lifting it with the barrel of the gun.
Yeah, I mean, if he thinks, you know, if he's confident that John is still within this room, kind of within this stretch of the ductwork, why not just spray another round of fire, you know, left to right or right to left, unless he kind of figures, well, if I missed, you know, I tried that once, it didn't work. Let me be more precise in my movements and see if I can figure out where this guy is.
Right. Well, it didn't work in what way? You didn't hear an ouch or a yelp or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, saying, oh, crap, you know, I got shot.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. And, you know, the music tone changes at this point. Mm-hmm. And it in some ways, it's trying to trick us because it gets a little more upbeat. You know, so because, you know, you'd think that it would be upbeat if we knew that John was safe. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, it's upbeat, meaning that maybe Carl is going to get him. That type of thing. And then we get a shot of John. And he's, you know, he has his gun in his hand. Which, you know, they neglected to actually show us him taking the gun out. Or you see that he lifts it, but I don't know. Last week, he stuffed that gun down his pants, down the front of his pants. Okay? He takes it out much too easily at this point. You know, there's a lot of, you know, it's done in a very smooth way, the way that he pulls it out here.
Yeah, so he not only needs to get this out from underneath him, but he needs to do it in a way that doesn't, you know, disturb the duck or make noise that to reel a bit.
Right, but he also needs to, like, you know, I guess move his pelvis up in order to be able to easily pull the gun out, because you know, if you're lying in the shaft, so, you know, his whole body is against the shaft itself.
Mm-hmm.
So he needs to arch himself in order to be able to arch himself and at the same time reach his hand back in order to pull the gun out and do this all very silently.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I guess John's had experience doing these type of things.
If you have any experience with sheet metal, like this kind of thin metal, like it makes noise as it bends, as weight is put on and released. You know, it isn't just any noise that John himself would make directly, but also indirect from the movement of the metal that he's got to avoid.
You would assume that there's a little bit of creaking of the metal or something like that, just because he's moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not even major creaking, even just minor creaking along the way. And stuff like that. I don't know. And then he pulls back the hammer of the gun. You know, so I like how I find it funny in movies that they always do this, you know. Because, I mean, John obviously needs to have a bullet in the chamber there. You know, he doesn't need to cock the gun. So all he's doing is just making it a little quicker that the hammer will already be back. But, you know, if he ends up using the gun, it's going to make a lot of noise anyway. It's not as if that's going to make it more silent.
Right.
You know, whether again, we mentioned yesterday we were talking about shooting guns or whatever. I don't know how much you've shot handguns as opposed to rifles or whatever it is. But if you're shooting a handgun, it's going to make the same amount of noise if you've pulled the hammer back or if you're just pulling the trigger on an automatic gun, because then it goes back on its own. You know, we're not talking about a six shooter or something like that.
Yeah. Would it? Yeah, I'm trying to think of what the effect was, because it's and usually not something I remember ever doing. I wonder if it might enable him to shoot quicker, because usually pulling the trigger, so there's the motion of, that moving the hammer back until it releases to fire. Whereas at this point, when he kind of manually pulls the hammer back, so he doesn't need to do that with the trigger.
Right.
The only thing the trigger's doing is going to release it.
Right. I mean, on like a six shooter or something like that, that is effective if you have the hammer back.
Yeah.
You know, then you have to apply less pressure.
A revolver versus this kind of pistol. Exactly.
Then you have to apply less pressure in order to actually shoot. But if you're dealing with an automatic, even if the hammer is back, the whole mechanism is still going to go back.
Yeah.
It's still going to make the same amount of noise. Yeah. I think it's more just for the viewer to see that he's in the ready.
That he's getting ready to fire. It's one of those movie things that you don't actually do and you wouldn't do in real life.
That's what I think. You know. And then we get another shot of Carl, who's once again poking the shaft. He's moving along a little bit here and there. You know, John then takes the gun and points it down towards where Carl is standing. You know, getting a little nervous. You know, you can see that John is scared and he's on edge at this point. You know, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? I don't know. And then I love the fact that we get to see Carl through the grating. Once again, we get to see it from John's perspective. You know, and it really works very well that they show it that way. Because also, we can see how close Carl is to where John is. You know, Carl is about to push on that part of the air shaft. You know, and at this point, the music also changes. It begins to like swell a little more and adds even more tension to everything going on. You know, what's going to happen? He's getting very close. How are we going to deal with it? You know, and then the concentration of both Carl and John is spoiled because then we hear Fritz screaming at Carl. And he goes, Carl, come, die Polizei. This is Carl, come, it's the police. And then we get another shot of Carl through the grating, and it's the two of them sort of, you know, make eye contact without realizing that they're making eye contact, or Carl realizing that he's making eye contact, because Carl doesn't know that John's there. John obviously knows that Carl is there.
Yeah, but yeah, Carl is looking right up at that grate, right where John is.
Right, and you'd think that he would see a shadow, he would see something. I don't know.
I guess not.
Right, and then Carl, before he runs off, pushes up the shaft a little bit in order to, you know, once again, make us think he's about to find him. but he at this point decides to, you know, just go with what Hans wants him to do. You know, leave him alone, mm-hmm. and you know, he quickly just runs out of the room. And then we see complete relief on John's face. You know, and I like the added touch here that we get to see him put the hammer back. Mm-hmm. You know, meaning that, you know, he is looking at it from a safety perspective. You know, that he doesn't want to, you know, jump the gun. Pun intended.
Yeah. What a kind of a signal to the audience. Like, so we know when he pulls that hammer back, oh, this is, you know, the tension has just been ramped up one more level. He's, you know, he's that close to, you know, possibly needing to fire to defend his life. And then Carl gets called away, and then he can kind of release that hammer to let us know as the audience, like we can breathe now. We can release.
Right. And we see John also, he sort of like semi-collapses in relief.
Yeah.
As to what's going on. You know, and then the scene changes and we get a shot of Al driving. You know, his car enters the plaza of the Nakatomi entranceway. Mm-hmm. We get a bird's eye view of it, and we get to see that he's in he's in car 110, which continues to remain that way. But then we also get a shot of one of the terrorists named James, who's looking down from the building. You know, he's really high up. So you'd think that, you know, he doesn't really get... You can't see that much from 30 floors up, can you? It looks as if,
yeah.
You know, the crane isn't 30 floors up. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
The crane shot that they use. And it makes us think that James is a lot on a lower level. Mm-hmm. But later on, we'll find out, I think we find out this week that he's, you know, that he still is very high up on the whole thing. But the shot that Jan de Bont gives here is great. You know, we see the figure eight of the whole plaza. We see the car come in. We see the car, you know, drive around it, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I mean, it's a great shot setting us up also to know, you know, how things look from above. You know, you have this random police car just show up. You know, so it's pretty interesting the way that they do that.
Yeah, our buddy Al Powell, and then another contrast with just the quiet of the night. This car slowly pulling in versus the high tension that we just went through inside.
What time do you think this is? What would be your guess?
Maybe around 9 o'clock.
Okay, well, sunset is at 4:50
mm-hmm.
on December 24th in LA. It doesn't matter what year,
right?
In our multiverse, I guess you could say. So, you know, I have trouble believing that 4 hours have passed. You know, it looks a lot. You know, I had the same issue last season with Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, that there are certain scenes that just look as if they take place so much later than they probably did. So, I mean, I agree with you that it looks like it's 9 o'clock, but I have trouble believing that this is 4 hours after the terrorists broke into the building.
Right. Yeah, probably not. I mean, it would make sense on Christmas Eve that the building, other than the people in this party, you know, the building would empty out earlier than regular. So I guess that makes sense in terms of kind of the place is deserted other than the party. And, you know, we don't see any other cars in the parking lot. There's no other, you know, none of the other tenants in the building are there. But in terms of dark, it looks like it seems to be well past sundown.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And then the shot changes and we get to see a leg dangling down. And, you know, reaching for the desk. And again, I love the touch that they're showing us John's bare feet once again to remind us that he's not wearing shoes. You know, this is not by chance that they're showing it to us this way. And so it's great the way that it does it. Now, I mean, you'd think that, I mean, it's very strange the way that he dangles his foot down and tries to get on the desk. and things like that. I would, you know, it's a strange decision to shoot it like this, in my perspective. What do you think about that? You think that works?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense from kind of the filmmaking standpoint of you know, wanting to draw our attention to the bare feet. It seems like it's, you know, it's not that far off the ground. It seemed like it would be easier just to drop straight down. And if there happened to be a desk or table, you know, directly underneath the grate that he's coming through, that's fine. But if it just drops onto the floor, it's not that far a drop. That it'd be easier for just, you know, just let go and drop rather than try to reach out to the desk.
Right, but I have a different issue with it. You know, when Carl was in the room, did we see that there was a desk there?
Oh.
Do you remember what we saw there?
I'm trying to see if it turns around. Oh, I didn't even, yeah, in that respect. So there was, yeah, so I don't think we see.
There's a copy machine there.
This desk. We see, yeah, there is a copy machine. There is some, you know, office equipment in that space.
But we don't see a desk.
Yeah, we don't see a desk. Yeah, this doesn't necessarily look like the same room.
Right. So I
yeah.
So I'm wondering, maybe he's went down in a different room. Is that possible? You think that there is that possibility?
That's possible. And that doesn't make a ton of sense. It would seem like
it doesn't make sense, but I'm trying to make it more plausible.
To make it more plausible that for whatever reason he's like, well, in case.
Right, because there's two,
you know,
computers,
you know,
I'm room.
Assuming he either, you know, McClane either doesn't speak German or perhaps didn't hear what, you know, what was said to call Carl away. Mm-hmm. So maybe thinks, well, he may be coming back. So McClane continues to crawl to another room before exiting the duct. You know,
right.
So I'm not going to just drop into this room where the guy just was in case he turns around and comes back.
Right.
I think the better view of the room is the previous minute, and there's definitely not, not a desk with a computer on
it. It doesn't mean that there isn't one there, but we don't see a desk.
We don't see a desk.
We see the photocopy machine and some other bit of office equipment, but not three desks that have two computers on them. Yeah. You know, and then he jumps down, and the way that he jumps down, he has 1 foot on the desk and then 1 foot in the air. That's going to hurt.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like it, and you know, from that angle, you'd be better off not, you know, just not doing anything with the desk at all, just drop straight down onto the floor.
Correct. And then so he drops down onto the floor, and then we get another shot of the car, of Al's car, in the plaza, and we see one of the terrorists, looking out a window. Now, what floor are the terrorists on?
Because this looks like the second or third floor. Someone's close to the ground.
They're on the 30th floor. Who's on the second floor looking at him? You know, that type of thing. It's very strange the way that he's looking at it from here.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've lost track of all the different terrorists that are moving around. I'm not sure who this is who has...
This is Alexander.
This is Alexander who has this viewpoint from a lower... It's raised up a little bit, but it's not... You know, it's not the 30-story view from the roof.
I think tomorrow we might know where he is, but I don't think he's on the second floor.
Yeah.
Because you can tell that this is Alexander by his hairstyle.
Okay.
And Alexander was always on the 30th floor with everyone else at the party. He was one of the guards that was guarding everyone.
Yeah.
So it's possible someone switched him or whatever it is, but like you said, it looks like he's on the second floor, but I don't know. Looks, you know, we'll get there tomorrow and maybe even Friday. There'll be a little bit of that. And then we see John back in the boardroom. You know, John is very, very tense. He is, you know, he does have his gun outstretched in front of him, making sure that, you know, he's not surprised by anything. And as he starts walking through the room, we get to see the glass doors, which are splattered with the brains and blood of Takagi.
Yeah.
I mean, I obviously they're not going to bring in a cleaning lady to fix it up because they don't really care. But
the girl has the day off.
Right. But it's still a little, you know, a little crude that they left it the way it is. And that, as John moves towards that door, that's how the minute ends. You know, we don't, we'll have to wait until tomorrow to see what happens there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So did you have anything else you wanted to say about this minute before we get into the script?
You know, that's all I have for minute 53. Yeah.
Okay. So,
oh no, I'm sorry. I do have one quick, well, maybe quick. We'll see. One more thing I had for this minute. One note is that, John's shirt has changed. His white t-shirt or white undershirt has now turned sort of, I don't know, olive green or gray. Which I guess you could explain it in the film as this is just all from dirt, you know, dirt from crawling through the air ducts, but it's kind of uniformly colored. It's so completely gray where it was white that I think he just, you know, from here on out, John McClane, you know, the actor Bruce Willis is wearing a different shirt than he had been previously.
Well, I think I mentioned at one point that they had 17 different versions of the shirt for him to use. Something like that. But my assumption is that you're right, that it's supposed to look that it's all dirty from going through the the shaft. You know, that there's probably a lot of dust in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, but on the other hand, they're still in the process of building this building. So you can't say that, okay, there's dust that's been settling in there for dozens of years or whatever it is. You know, theoretically, it's just a few months or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So is this symbolic of something, like coming through the duct and emerging the other end could be, you know, a symbolic or a metaphorical rebirth. And now it's changed from, you know, from the good, you know, good guys wear white, from the cop, the guy who's on the side of law and order. And now he's come through, you know, rebirth on the other side of that ductwork. He's now kind of the vigilante renegade. Not entirely working inside of the, you know, the all the bounds of the laws. Maybe now he's ready.
That's what my captain keeps telling me.
Yeah, now he's ready to go outside the lines because he's dirty now.
Wow, I never even thought of that. That's a great way to look at it. I never thought to even go that to go into the existential aspects of what does it mean that his shirt is no longer white.
Neither did I until just now.
Hey, why not? It works.
Yeah, maybe
it works. So the script has a few, again, descriptions. You know, they're not really discrepancies here. Mm-hmm. So it starts off, Carl listens patiently for sound. Just then the two other terrorists return. Carl hesitates a moment, fighting his instincts before finally turning to go. Suddenly the duct McClane is in groans slightly under his weight. Carl stops and looks up at the matrix of aluminum ductwork, trying to single out the source of the sound. He steps back into the room and raises his rifle, holding it upright to press. He presses the barrel up into the belly of McClane's air duct, feeling for weight, the weight of a body. So, I like the way they describe it here, but I think visually it just works better the way that they filmed it. I don't think they needed to really go into the whole fact of him, you know, that he's maybe going to leave and, you know, he's debating whether to stay or leave.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact that he looks up and says, okay, I shot. Now I'm going to check, you know, it's he's being methodical.
Methodical, yeah.
In everything that he's doing. So I think that works to show it that way. One of the things that they mention in the script is, it says that John can hear Carl's footsteps on the concrete moving slowly below the duct. There is no grate in the script.
Mm-hmm.
So John can't see him. So again, I think it's a great change that they made so that we can see from John's perspective how close Carl really is here.
Yeah. It makes sense. And, you know, film being a visual medium.
Yeah.
Giving us that sight. It was natural change.
Right. And the only other difference here is this actually has the scene where Theo gets through the first lock.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the computer says, do you wish to proceed? He goes, you bet your ass I'm going to proceed. You know, that we mentioned a few weeks ago already. So it was just in a different place. But I like where they placed it. Where they placed it in the movie, as opposed to here in the script.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So every Wednesday, we have a segment called Hans Hunt Day, where my guests will give their top five Alan Rickman performances.
All right.
Now, you can include Die Hard here, just so you know.
Okay. So I can
include... had a few guests that... you know, that forgot that they can add that in here.
Okay. Yeah, so I can include Die Hard, and I will include Die Hard, so I guess spoiler alert. So I'll start at number five. My number five Alan Rickman performance is Bottle Shock from 2008. And this is a film he's in with Chris Pine that's about kind of how the California wines became more recognized for their quality. So Alan Rickman plays he's a Brit who's in Paris and owns a failing wine shop and travels to California looking for, you know, something new and different that he can introduce, you know, in his shop, and kind of centers on a blind taste test that was devised to kind of prove that the California wines were just as good, you know, as anything coming out of, you know, coming out of Europe and particularly France. But it's you know, not a big blockbuster like Die Hard, but I think it's a nice little film, and you get a good Alan Rickman performance.
I actually just saw it yesterday. I'd never seen it before.
No.
I saw it based on a recommendation from, you know, one of the previous guests. Yeah. They mentioned it, and I was interested in seeing it. I liked it. I didn't think it was great. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't count it as one of my top five Alan Rickman performances, and it was very strange seeing Chris Pine with long hair.
Yeah,
it was actually disturbing.
Yeah,
you know, because you think of Chris Pine, at least I think of Chris Pine. I think of one of two things. I'll either think of James T. Kirk.
Yeah,
or I'll think of
what else
from Wonder Woman.
Oh yeah, is that Steve Rogers?
Steve Rogers.
And is that the,
yeah. No, Steve Rogers is Captain America, isn't he?
Oh no.
Steve Rogers, yeah. Same thing, you know.
Yeah, Steve Trevor.
Yeah, so no, it was a little disturbing to see him there like that.
Yeah, a little bit against type for Chris Pine for what he's known for these days. Yeah, I mean, not one of my favorite movies, but I think a decent enough movie, a good film, and again, I like the Alan Rickman performance, so putting that in at number five. For number four from 2005, and I know this has come up previously from other guests, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where Alan Rickman provides the voice of, you know, Marvin, the depressed android. And, you know, he's got that great, he's so good in this film, but he's so good, you know, just that Alan Rickman voice, that deadpan delivery, that he does so well. So even though it's just his voice, I think it you know, rightfully merits a place on this list. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy at number four. My number three from 1988, Die Hard,
I don't think I've ever seen that one. What happens there?
The Die Hard?
Yeah.
You should check it out. It's a good film.
All right. I'll put that on my list.
Put that on your
list. Maybe I'll get to it by the end of the year or something.
Yeah. So yeah, Die Hard from 1988. You know, Hans Gruber, we've seen a little bit of him so far. You'll see a lot more of him to come. So I don't think there's too much I need to say about that. Both my top two coincidentally happen to be from 1999. So number two, Dogma, the Kevin Smith film, with Alan Rickman playing an angel who's shepherding the last descendant of Jesus to save the world. But he's a little bit similar character to Marvin the android that he played in Hitchhiker's Guide. I don't know if you can properly describe an angel as depressed, but he's certainly not happy most of the time. I guess you exist long enough, you get tired of existence. So he's a little bit weary of the universe, even though he is trying to save it. But we get a nice Rickman performance in Dogma. And then at number one, also from 1999, Galaxy Quest, which is, really a great movie, one of my favorites. But Alan Rickman playing, playing an actor who's playing an alien in a Star Trek type show. More of that weariness and the deadpan delivery that Rickman did so well. you know, someone who thinks of himself as, you know, sort of a serious actor, but then became known, became famous for doing, you know, sci-fi and not, you know, not as serious dramatic work, but then, you know, just to kind of pay the bills, he's stuck, you know, stuck reprising that character. And he just, you know, really captures that, that character and that character's arc, who, you know, really regrets, or you know, kind of, you know, isn't happy about being in that position, but then later, I think comes to, you know, appreciate what that character has meant to, you know, to the audience. And so, gains a new appreciation for his own work. So, yeah, my number one Alan Rickman performance, Galaxy Quest.
All right. That's great. So you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
You know, once again, I'm from Next Scene Podcast at nextscenepod.com. And also, I've done some other stuff. I did This is Spinal Tap, 1 minute at a time for Spinal Tap Minute. I also covered Groundhog Day, 1 minute at a time. And all my podcast stuff, you know, previous podcasts as a host and also my guest appearances are at my main site, which is at catandsean.org. That's C-A-T and Sean, S-E-A-N.org. And yeah, so, you know, check that out for, you know, for other stuff that I've done podcast-wise.
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher you might be using to listen to this show. Finding me is very simple. You can go to my website, movierobminute.com, or you can just do a quick search and find me either on Twitter or Facebook. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay! We'll be right back.